On your mark, get ready, go! Listen to our podcast because our guest today is Mark Summers from the hit Nickelodeon show Double Dare. He's also executive producer on many shows on Food Network. And we were fortunate enough to have him on our other show, Two Buffoons, where we got to interview him about some really funny things that happened in his life, including the infamous fight he had with Burt Reynolds on The Tonight Show, some of his appearances at the Magic Castle in California, one of the most prestige magic places they have around the U.S., I think.
Prestigious magic.
Yeah, it was pretty cool to
that was the doorbell.
Yeah, that's the doorbell. When you hit it, it goes,
prestigious magic.
And it's also when you flush the toilet, too, it does that.
Yeah, it goes,
prestigious poop.
Magic.
No, it was cool to have Mark back and to talk to him about his early days in stand-up, because I feel like everyone knows him from Double Dare and What Would You Do and Unwrapped and all those Food Network shows that he produces. But it was really cool to sit down with him. We weren't with him sitting down. We were sitting. He was walking somewhere. But to talk about...
He was walking as far away as he possibly could from us. He said, I'm in California. You guys are in New York. Tell me which way heads me further towards San Francisco, and I will head there.
Yeah, he thought that if he walked away, he would find an area with a bad signal that would, you know, cancel the call without him being mean and hanging up. He was letting nature
nature take its course. Yeah,
exactly.
But it didn't. It was what stunk for him is that the call not only lasted, but it was very clear.
It couldn't have been clearer, and unfortunately for him, he couldn't have been nicer.
Divulged prestige
magic.
I mean, I think if we keep talking, we're just gonna reenact everything he said.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, here we go.
All right. Hey guys, it's me, Mark.
Oh, hey Mark, thanks for coming on the show. It's Ryan and
gotta go.
Oh, that's exactly how it went. Man, what a nice guy.
All right, that's good.
All right, well, it's episode 3 of Joke Artists, and our guest today is Mark Summers, and it's hard to hold back saying Mark Summers when you say your name, because it's just so iconic and brings back just such great memories. Mark, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. You know, I hear the word iconic a lot recently, and it's something that you never think is going to come before your name, and who knew when we were doing those shows at Nick back in the day and even at Food Network with Unwrapped that they turned into what they turned into.
Yeah, I mean, incredible.
Is that weird for you to wake up and look in the mirror and go, I am iconic, and then you brush your hair and...
I never say those words, but, you know, it's just so odd when people say that to me, you know, because to me, you know, Frank Sinatra is iconic, Sammy Davis Jr. is iconic, those people are iconic, you know, Johnny Carson. So I don't put myself anywhere near that category, but it's flattering to think that you had such an impact on a particular generation, and, you know, that just happens for some reason. I can't figure out why.
Well, I think you need to write a crooner album then. You need to start singing.
Yeah.
I'd love to do that. That would be amazing.
Well, everybody knows you from Unwrapped and What Would You Do and Double Dare. And what struck me was I don't think many people know that there is a video of you online from 1973 on the Celebrity Review, and you're doing magic and stand-up. And whenever I mention this to people go, whoa, he did magic and stand-up? How did you get into that, and what made you kind of want to blend stand-up with magic?
Well, actually, you should go look at a show called Norm Crosby's Comedy Shop, which is also online, where I did stand-up back, may have been 75, 76. I came out of the womb in Indianapolis, Indiana, knowing exactly what I wanted to do, which was be on television. But the problem is, when you're in Indiana and your dad runs a grocery store and your mom's a homemaker, how the hell does that even happen? And so I used to come home from school and turn on the ABC affiliate at the time in NDWLWI, and I would see this young guy by the name of Johnny Carson do a show called Who Do You Trust? And I thought, oh, this guy is amazing, and did research and found out that he was a magician. And I figured, well, maybe that's how I get on stage, is by doing magic. And there was a kid down the street, Dave Lawton, who was part of a magic club at West Lane Junior High, where I was soon to go. And he started teaching me magic, and then I joined the magic club. And realized, you know, I was pretty good on stage, and I just was having a ball and also starting to make some money doing birthday parties and, you know, weddings and bar mitzvahs and dog shows and wakes and whatever I could do back in the day in Indiana. And I started to make some money and, you know, watch Johnny's career grow as he went to the Tonight Show. And, you know, the goal when I came out to L.A. in 73 was, well, Johnny's got to be retiring soon. And, you know, I want that job. Little did I know that, you know, 5,000 other people across the country felt the same way. And I was actually I was a regular at the Magic Castle in Los Angeles when I first moved out to audition and became the youngest performer there at the time. And and then I wanted to start at the Comedy Store and used to stand in line on Monday nights on open mic nights until I became a regular in July of 76. And I was opening for Gallagher at a place called The Laugh Stop in Newport Beach.
Wow.
And he came out to me and said, his words, "Hey, Summers, you're a real a-hole." And I said, "Why is that?" He goes, "How much are they paying you to open for me?" Because I was primarily doing magic. And I said, $150. And he said, "That's why you're an a-hole, because you're a novelty act." Funny, coming from a guy who worked props and that kind of stuff. And he was telling me I was a prop comic. And so he said, "You know, the comics that open for me make $300. They're paying you half because you walk out with a deck of cards and you cut a rope." So I started to slowly wean the magic out of my act and do stand up. And, you know, that was sort of the beginning of it in the mid 70s.
It was that watermelon that you were missing. That was yes. The key.
Thank heavens.
He was like, "You need a watermelon, kid." And you're like, "Yes, Mr. Gallagher."
Well, that's what's funny is because some of your magic, you know, it was like in that clip I had mentioned, you have magic tricks that are just meant for a punchline. And then, like you mentioned with the cutting the rope trick, that's actually pretty amazing. So there is this blend of like, wow, this is really funny, but it's also, wow, like how do you do that? So the blend of the two.
There was a person who sort of mentored me when I first came to LA at the Magic House. His name was Peter Pitt. And Peter was a really good magician from Holland. First thing he did when he came to the States was the Ed Sullivan Show in the late 50s. And he, for whatever reason, took me under his wing and started to groom me as a, you know, comic magician, which was sort of a thing that didn't exist back then. And he sort of owned that spot back then and was running the castle as far as booking acts or whatever, and took a liking to me and helped nurture my my career into that thing. And you know, magic, for some reason, amazes and mystifies people. And I took to it rather quickly and easily. And to this day, I still do it. You know, I have grandkids now, and it's fun to do magic for them. But, you know, most people don't know that part of my career. You know, they kind of think of me as a guy who introduced green slime on Nickelodeon and put Nick on the map. But, you know, I started my career as a professional magician. That's how I put myself through college. And, you know, then did the stand-up, did warm-ups, wrote on game shows. The first game show I ever wrote on was Truth or Consequences, and last year Bob Barker hosted that. So I've been doing this almost 40 years now. Hard to believe.
And how did you get that gig writing for Truth or Consequences?
Yeah.
I was a page at CBS Television City. There was a guy by the name of Mark Smith who was working on the show and knew I had an interest in, you know, starting to write and be around game shows because I wanted to host them. And he got me an audition there. And this is a really sweet story. So I went to his house one night, and for 4 or 5 hours, we just wrote stunts that Barker would hopefully do. And I left and thought, this is fantastic. And he said, "Well, I'll turn him into Ed Bailey, our producer, on Monday." And Tuesday they call me and hire me, and I find out that the stuff I wrote was pretty pathetic. Mark rewrote everything, put my name on it, and that's how I got the job, which was one of the nicest things anybody's ever done for me. Yeah. And we're still friends to this day.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 50 years.
Wow,
yeah.
That's incredible.
Did you fall in love with how Johnny Carson did that first game show, and that's what got you into doing it, or do you think that you would have wanted to do a game show or be a game show host? Because I know you wanted to be a host, but would you have wanted to be a game show host if you had never seen Carson? Like, if Carson didn't exist before The Tonight Show, doing his show, do you think you would have resonated with another game show host?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you what it was. When I was, as a kid, staying home sick from school, or pretending to be sick from school, game shows were on NBC, CBS, and ABC, you know, all morning. And I took a liking to Bob Barker when he was doing Truth or Consequences on NBC. And I thought there was something magic and special about him. And the fact that the first show I worked on was Truth or Consequences, and then I was a page on Price is Right, and got to know Bob really well and worked for – he had a company for a while, and I used to write questions for his shows and things like that. All so right. It was weird to grow up watching a guy on TV and then actually become friends with him. Right. But he was probably my first influence as a game show guy.
Oh, right. That's wild. So, and so then, I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I want to know, what was that jump to hosting Double Dare? Like, how did you make the leap from, you know, writing for Truth or Consequence and doing magic and stand-up and then jumping into that hosting gig? Was it like a call or?
I was auditioning a lot and not getting the jobs, because back in the day it was Barker and all these guys, Bill Cullen and older game show hosts. And I would go to audition and they'd say, "You look like a Boy Scout. Come back when you have gray hair and wrinkles." And I was too young. And I also looked at the time, you know, 10 years younger than I really was. When I was auditioning at 33 for game shows, they always thought I was in my mid-20s for whatever reason. And so a friend of mine, Dave Garrison, who was a ventriloquist and a friend from Indianapolis, had moved out and was doing ventriloquism in clubs and got tired of it and decided he wanted to go behind the scenes and become a producer. So he gets a phone call one day in July of 86 saying, you know, this network called Nickelodeon, we're looking for a game show host. And he called me and said, "Look, I don't want to do this. Maybe you should go instead of me." And I found out that they had auditioned 1,000 people in New York and didn't like anybody. And they came out to LA and I was the first person to audition. So they yelled out Dave Garrison. And I said, "Well, Dave couldn't make it. My name's Mark. And I auditioned instead." And they said, "Yes," which I don't think you could even do today. And I went in and I thought, knocked it out of the park. I got 3 callbacks, and that August they were going to start shooting in September. And when I got the final callback, they were 2 weeks away from shooting. I didn't hear from them, so I called Mike Klinghoffer, who's exec producer, and I said, "Have you guys made a decision?" And he said, "We got to narrow it down to you and another guy, but we just can't figure out, you know, who we should hire." Because when we did the auditions, they had grown-ups playing the part of kids, and they didn't know if we were good interacting with kids. And so I said, "Why don't you put us in a studio with kids and see what happens?" And that's what they did. They flew us both out to New York. We both hosted the show. 2 days later, they called me and they said, "You got the job." And I said, "Out of all the people you auditioned, 2,000 people, what was it that stood out that got me the job?" And he said, "Well, quite honestly, you and this last guy were about the same." But at the end of his audition, he looked at the camera and said, "Do you guys want me to do anything else?" And I looked in the camera and said, "We'll be back with more Double Dare after this." And because I threw it to commercial, they thought that was more professional. And that changed my life.
Wow.
That's awesome.
And what did you have to do in the initial audition?
Ask questions and do physical challenges. You know, they wanted to see how well you could take charge. Could you describe a physical challenge in 10 or 15 seconds, make it understood, pull it off, and then could you do the commentary in between? Because that was important. If you didn't, it was just dead air and people, you know, doing these ridiculous things. But could you do a play-by-play a la Howard Cosell and make it interesting? And I guess I had a knack for that. And I had, you know, here's the deal. If I would have gotten this audition when I was 22, 23, when I first came to LA, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But I was so seasoned from doing magic, from doing stand-up, from doing the Comedy Store, from doing the improv, from doing warm-ups on TV, that I was so ready that, you know, it was perfect timing and it just worked out.
Did you stop stand-up then at the time? So when you got the gig, did you say, "Okay, I don't want to do stand-up anymore," or did you continue it?
You know, I was never a really successful stand-up comic. I was always an opening act. I would do colleges and I would do, you know, 20 minutes and then, you know, the real acts were there. And, you know, keep in mind, I started in the 76 with Dave Letterman, Robin Williams, Jay Leno, Gary Shandling, and those guys, you know, knocked that out of the park every night. And I was an observational comic and I was pretty ordinary. It worked for a while, but I don't think I was ever going to make it, you know, to my own sitcom or anything like that. So it was a means to get from point A to point B. I wish I had more talent as a comic. I just couldn't pull it off.
And what was your writing process like when you were doing stand-up and magic? Because, you know, watching a clip of you perform, you started off with a trick, then you did kind of your typical joke stand-up, and then you segued back into more kind of more serious magic, not serious, but, you know, kind of...
Yeah, a little more, yeah.
Yeah, like, let's get to the magic. So how did you wrestle kind of organizing that?
Luckily, at the Magic Castle, there were people that I could use to pick their brain and say, you know, what should I do here? What should I do there? There was a comedian by the name of and magician Billy McComb, who was from England. Peter Pitt, who I mentioned, was there. And I also worked a lot back in the early days with Harry Anderson. And we used to do shows together all the time. And Harry was brilliant. I mean, the first time I saw him on stage, we were the same age.
And I was blown away. I thought, oh my God, you know, I'll never be that good. And so what we used to be able to do back in the day and at the Comedy Store as well, people would help you. I'd go on stage and do my 10, 12 minutes. And then I'd walk off stage and Shanley would say, you know, that one joke you told about going to the supermarket, it would be better if you move this word here and you got out of it quicker. And he was a wordsmith. And so people would help each other and it just sort of evolved. You know, it would take to do a good 10, 12 minute bit could take you at least take me 6-8 months to get a good 10, 12 minutes, you know? So it was a work in progress always.
Do you think that stand up is still that way now?
No.
Where people help each other? No.
No, I think it's every man for themselves or every woman for themselves. I don't think the camaraderie exists. The few times over the last several years when I've been to a comedy club, I just don't feel the camaraderie. Mm. I don't feel the energy of, I can help this guy or girl. And you know, I just don't feel it. You know, there would be times where, you know, I'd be doing a gig, I don't know, somewhere in Sacramento, and I'd get a call to do a gig on the same night. And so you'd call one of your friends, my friend Glenn Super, who's a comic, Ellis Levinson, all these guys I started with back in the day, and you would share. And that's what guys used to do back when, you know, the Ed Sullivan days with the Jack Carters and the, you know, you name it. The comics were always nice to each other and they assisted each other and they wanted everybody to be successful. I just don't get that same feeling today. Maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't feel it.
What do you think changed?
I don't know. I think it's sort of survival of the fittest now. And the other thing was when I started to do Monday nights at the Comedy Store, there might have been 35, 40 people line up on a Monday night. Now everybody thinks there's funny. So there's hundreds of people at every open mic night, at every comedy club across America. And nobody, you know, there's just not that many funny people. I think it's something that you're born with. I don't think you can learn it. I think you either have the instincts or you don't. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are out there who think they're funny and they're just not, you know, and name the last comic. I mean, other than Sebastian Maniscalco, who stands out in my mind, you know, there's like a handful of people who to me make me laugh these days, you know?
Do you think it could be that kind of similar to your story? People are getting into the industry by doing stand up, but they can't see that it can lead to something else. Whereas you went into it knowing, hey, this isn't really my strong suit, but I love hosting. I love being in front of a crowd and I'm going to improve on my ability to speak quickly, to interact with the crowd, and then I'm going to be out and have kind of be where I'm at. Do you think people are missing that foresight?
Yeah, to a certain extent. But see, when I started the Comedy Store in 76, it was not unusual for Norman Lear to walk in and, you know, give you a sitcom. You know, Jimmy Walker, you know, got on Good Times because Norman Lear walked in and saw him. Richard Pryor was doing a variety show on NBC. He'd walk into the store and say, hey, anybody want to be on my show tonight? Come on, you know, and he'd grab, you know, Robin Williams and four other people and they drive to NBC and they'd be on the show. You know, those things just don't happen these days. And I also don't think, you know, there's no school on how to do this.
Right.
And I think you have to study it. And that's what I did. I was a student of comedy and sitcoms. And, you know, I knew who Dick Van Dyke was before anybody. Dick Van Dyke was doing game shows on CBS, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s. But, you know, nobody knew who he was back then. And so I always had a passion for this kind of thing and did my homework. And I think it all paid off.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I 100%. Have you tried to go back and do magic and stand up, you know, since, like, you know, since I don't know, maybe like from late 90s to now?
Yeah, every now and then, you know, I get called to host something or MC something and I bring it back and it's fun to do. You know, whenever I was on Double Dare, I would try to throw in a trick or something that was magic-ish every couple of shows just to keep my chops, you know, together. But when I get called now to do an event, there's two or three things that I always rely on magic-wise that always work. And it kind of shocks people because, once again, they have no idea that's my background. So when I walk out and do this insane card trick, there's also another thing online where there was a group of folks who the third Friday of every or Thursday or Friday of every month called Don't Quit Your Night Job in New York. And there's a video of me on there doing a card trick that blows people's minds. And so, you know, I can actually do this stuff, believe it or not. I know how it works and I know how to do it. But yeah, I just don't do it that often anymore.
Do you think that people can do it now, though? Do you think that they could use that form of comedy? Do you think they could do stand-up and magic right now, and they could do that and transform into something else that they want to do?
Yeah. You know, Justin Willman is pulling that off. He used to go under the name of Justin Credible, and now he's going to his real name. And I think, although he's probably more magic than comedy,
right?
I think, because I tour a lot, and I get in the cities where Justin is often, and I find him to be the best act working in clubs today. He's just magnificent.
You mentioned his name and the name change. I was curious to kind of ask you, because we saw a video where you explained that Mark Summers is not your original name.
No, I woke up one morning and they said, we found the son of Sam. His name is David Berkowitz. And I thought, oh, Jesus, that was my real name, Mark Berkowitz. I thought of all the names. Yeah. Forgive me, I'm taking my 5-mile walk and there's a gentleman with a lawnmower behind me. So that's why all the noise is going on there. I woke up and I thought of all the names, Jesus. And so the phone rang 2 seconds later. It was like 8:15 on that morning. And my agent said, nobody knows who you are anyway. You're going to change your name. I won't be able to get you work anywhere. And so, you know, I never planned on changing my name. And it's a weird thing to think about. And there was a disc jockey that I grew up with in Indianapolis. And when I moved to Boston, he was there. His name was Dick Summer. And I got to know him. And so I just took his last name, Summer, added an S, became Mark Summers, and started to work like crazy because the most anti-Semitic people in show business are other Jews. And so Mark Berkowitz wasn't working, but Mark Summers was. So, go figure that out.
Wow. So two questions on that. One, how quickly did you change your name? And two, how quickly did you get work once you did change your name?
Took me about 6 months to come up with a name. I was trying a million different things because back in the day, I was a disc jockey when I was 15. And back in the DJ days, it was always one syllable first names and two syllable last names. So, you know, Dick Summer, Mark Summers. And I was trying to figure out what felt comfortable because, you know, it's not your name and you got to get used to it.
Right.
And it was almost instantaneous when I became Summers.
Really?
That I just started. Yeah, it was the oddest thing. But I had a friend who was a comic, Howie Itzkowitz, okay? And Howie was really funny, but couldn't get a lot of work. He changed his name to Howie Stevens, started to work all the time. So it was a different time. It was the 70s. And there was a lot of, you know, you couldn't have that kind of an ethnic name. Now I don't think it makes a bit of difference at all. But back then it was still, you know, a crucial part of moving forward in your career.
I thought it was so weird because when they brought back Double Dare, the new host, Jason Katz, changed his name to Jason Harris.
Yes.
I also thought, I was like, okay, that was also, you know, just another coincidence of a name change of somebody who is hosting Double Dare. I mean, I'm sure people brought that up to you a bunch of times.
Oh, yeah. Often. Yeah. Often.
And if Son of Sam did not exist, would you have changed your name, do you think? Or
probably not. It didn't make any difference to me. I never went in thinking I was going to change. Now, when I was on the radio, I was Mark Vaughn. I was Mark Monroe. I think all the names when I was a DJ, but never liked any of those names. And some was just kind of, and I tell you, the funny thing about my name is when people talk to me or refer to me, it's always one word, Mark Summers. It's not Mr. Summers or Summers or Mark. It's always Mark Summers. It's like one word, which just cracks me up for some reason, but it just is. So it rings in people's minds and obviously in people who book talent. And so it's been a positive thing all the way around.
For the rest of the interview, can we start every question with Mark Summers?
what was your family's reaction or friends' reaction when you did change your name, or when they, you know, when they had just sort of seen you on TV and you were going by the name Mark Summers and they may have been caught off guard? Did anybody contact you and say, hey, what, like, you changed your name?
Well, yeah, I was working the Improv one night and they said, please welcome to the Comedy of Mark Summers. I walked down like being heckled. You're not Mark Summers, you're Mark Berkowitz. And it was a friend of mine, Bob Dinson, I went to high school with back in Indiana. And so that happened. And then other people said, you know, they were watching Double Dare. I hadn't seen them in 20 years and they were watching Double Dare with their kids. And they said, you know, please welcome Mark Summers. And I walk out and they say, that's not Mark Summers, that's Mark Berkowitz. So, yeah, a lot of people were shocked. And of course, the question is why? And it makes sense after you tell the story, I guess. But no, it was never something in my mind that I thought, well, you know, like George Burns was Nathan Birnbaum and Jerry Lewis was Joseph Levitch and, you know, Jack Benny was Benny Kabelski. I think back then everybody was changing their name, but it was a different time once again.
Right. You know? And speaking of Jerry Lewis, I mean, I know you're a big Jerry Lewis fan and I mean, I know you got to interview him, and I watched that story on how you got the opportunity to interview him, and it was just a wild, wild story. But what was it really like to interview him? Because he is not, in the interview that I watched when you're interviewing him on your show, he doesn't come across as like the nicest guy.
He scared the hell out of me initially, and then I had the most bizarre, rocky relationship with him. It was on again, off again. I met him backstage when he opened in Damn Yankees in New York. It was me, a friend of mine, Bert Dubrow, and Jerry Springer were invited, and we all went together. And I asked him to do my talk show, and he came over and was a bit of a pain in the ass, quite honestly, and hassled me. And I could tell you endless stories of things that he did to make me feel uncomfortable. I give you the best one. I get a phone call from his office that he wanted me to do the Jerry Lewis telethon. I said, great. And I get to the studio Sunday morning, and Kenny Stein, the stage manager, says, I got a message from Jerry. He doesn't want you to look at him at all when you do the segment. I said, what? He said, don't look at him. He'll introduce you, walk down, hit your mark, and then when you're done, just go stage left. Do not go to the right, and do not talk to him. Okay, great. And so, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mark Summers. I come down, I read my thing, you know, send your money to MDA. And as I'm walking stage left, I hear Jerry go, hey, Mark, come here. Well, I was told no matter what Jerry says, do not under any circumstance look at him or talk to him or go over to him. And so I'm still going stage left, and the stage manager, Kenny, is telling me to come towards him. And he goes, Mark, I said, come here. So now all of a sudden, Kenny is pointing me back in the other direction. And then Jerry does what Jerry does. He didn't hear this guy is fantastic. And he put his arm around me, and he's, you know, hosts one of the best kid shows in the country. And he made Nickelodeon what it is. Please, ladies and gentlemen, one big more hand for Mark Summers. And he would do that stuff all the time. It was all premeditated because he liked to screw with people. And wow. He was a complex guy. And it's one of those things about meeting your heroes. Sometimes you just don't want to do that, because meeting Jerry Springer turned out to be fantastic, because he was even nicer than I thought he was. A smart man, a kind man in so many different ways. And, you know, meeting Barker, and, you know, I've met so many people in my career. But Lewis might be the strangest guy I've ever interacted with in my entire life. And I got to know him to a certain extent, but he loved screwing with me. That's all I can tell you. But it wasn't only me. I talked to several other people where the things he did to me, he did the exact same things to other people, because he loves, like I said, screwing around and making you feel uncomfortable.
So do you think there was any malice in that, or it was just the fun of messing with somebody?
I think both. I think he thought he was on a level different than me, you know, and show business back in the day was a little bit different. After I did the Tonight Show with Burt Reynolds and that whole, debacle happened, the next day his publicist referred to me as a bottom feeder of show business who didn't give the movie star any respect. And it's like, really? Give me a break.
Oh, my God.
But that's the way it is. You know, there's a pecking order. And I never got into this business to be rich and famous. I had a passion for it. It's what I wanted to do. I was lucky enough to get in and be successful and have some fun doing it. But, you know, some people got in it for all the wrong reasons and executed it beautifully, you know?
Yeah, it's just wild, because I know, like, I'm a big Jerry Lewis fan. But, you know, after seeing the interview, when you're interviewing him and, you know, he instantly messes with you on the couch and
– yep.
I'm like, it stinks, because I'm such a big fan of his, and watching him do that to you on your own show, I'm like, I don't know. I can't tell if he is genuinely trying to be actually funny or just being rude.
Well, you know, and the other thing about it was, I asked a question about, I said, forgive me if I'm wrong and correct me, but I said, there's a lot of people out doing you, in particular Jim Carrey, who I thought was basically doing an impression of Jerry Lewis. But I said, there's nobody asking Jerry Lewis to do Jerry Lewis movies. And it got very quiet in the studio, and he looked at me, and I thought he was going to walk off. And then I brought up the Academy Award. And when he said, I've never done, I asked him if The Nutty Professor was the best thing he ever did, and he said yes. And I said, how do you feel about never getting an Academy Award? And he said, I've never done anything to deserve one, which I thought was the most honest thing I ever heard him say.
Wow. Yeah, it made sense, you know, that he said that. The only part that I guess didn't make sense is that I kept, you know, seeing, obviously, interview after interview of him just, you know, treating people not right. But it is kind of, you know, it is, it, not kind of, it's very cool that you still, were also not treated right. You know what I mean? Like you fell amongst the crowd of like people who maybe idolized him, and he treated you just like he would have treated somebody else who was interviewing him. And it's cool that you kind of got to be treated like crap in a way,
but in a good way.
You know what I mean? Like he acknowledged that, and it's so just cool that you guys got to become, you know, friends to a certain degree of you know, of that nature. It was odd.
It was odd. You know, when he came and did the interview, I had done some research, as I always do, and found out that he had written a textbook on film that, you know, they used at USC to teach kids about how to make movies. And when I brought it out, he said, "How the hell did you know about this?" And I said, that's my job, man, you know?
Yeah.
And so I got him to sign that book, and that was cool. But he was an odd man. You know, you can't knock his talent. He was, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, brilliant. Did he grow beyond that? Not necessarily. If you want to see something that's painful, he used to do a 2-hour talk show on ABC on Saturday nights back in the 60s. And recently I found them online, I think on YouTube. And if you want to see some of the most uncomfortable television that you've ever seen in your entire life, because it becomes the Jerry Lewis, "I'm the best thing in the world, screw everybody else" show. And you just cringe watching it. It's so horrible.
Oh no.
Yeah.
So now, I know you mentioned Sebastian Maniscalco. Are there other comics out there, you know, or comedians that you, I'm obviously, you know, maybe not idolize now in a way because, you know, they might be younger or older, but like, are there other ones that you follow now and you were like, oh, you know, I could have sort of, I would have been more like that comic if I continued doing like, you know, more comedy. Is there anybody like that out there?
Sebastian, to me, is like an old guy in a young person's body, you know?
Yeah.
And he's sort of an old school comic, but on a younger set.
Right.
And so I identify with that. I try and watch a lot of these other acts when they do these specials on HBO, whenever. And I just don't laugh that hard, you know?
Yeah.
I just, you know, where I went to see Sebastian, I live up in Santa Barbara, and he was at the Santa Barbara Bowl last summer, went to see him. And I laughed my ass off for 90 minutes. I just thought he was fantastic. You know, and then there's Bill Maher, who, you know, is my age, and we start about the same time. But he's a smart comic, and I admire what he does as well.
Right.
But, you know, Trevor Noah, I saw him perform not too long ago. I was doing a thing called Clusterfest up in San Francisco, and I was performing, and then he was performing. And he killed. He freaking killed. And then Jon Stewart followed him, and he killed. And so there's some amazing, you know, executioner comic type folks who know how to set it up, deliver it, and give you a hell of a punchline. And they do exist. But I don't know a lot of the real young guys. I just don't stay in touch with that. You know.
Has anybody who you started out with, like when you were doing Magic and Comedy, has anybody been resentful to you because you became such a famous host?
I can't think of one, you know, because once again, it was always one for all and all for one, and we all helped each other.
Right.
You know, Harry Anderson exploded before all of us, and he went crazy, but was always the nicest guy in the world. Night Court, and I did the warm up on the pilot of Night Court. That was such a weird thing.
Wow, what was that
so,
like?
Well, you know, it was hard. It was such a quirky show. That, you know, I had done a lot of warm-ups back in the day, and I wasn't too sure that one was going to, you know, be successful. But obviously I was wrong. It worked out extremely well for many years.
Yeah.
But I can't think of anybody of all the people I started off with. You know, I started, you know, Leno is always probably the nicest comedian you've ever want to meet in your entire life. He's just genuine and kind to every human. You know, Letterman and I, you know, had played racquetball and knew each other and, you know, and were involved with the Comedy Store strike back in the day and all that stuff. But I don't think anybody's ever close with Dave. I used to go over and hang out when Double Dare was this, you know, big cult hit. And I used to go backstage over at the NBC show when it was late night and hang out with Dave. And you know, he's quirky. Sometimes he's very nice to me and sometimes he's not so nice to me. And that's just the way he is, you know.
But you've been used to that.
I get used to it. You know, Sandling was always very kind, very helpful. That's right. Robin Williams, probably the sweetest guy in the history of the world, just kind. And it was always about you, not about him. And, I went to some big dinner in New York that was honoring him. And I walked in the room and it was, you know, Walter Cronkite and, you know, these, you know, every movie star you can imagine. And I said to him, he had just walked out of the kitchen. He ran into me, gave me a hug. And I said, "What do you think when you walk out here and you see all these people of this stature here to honor you. And he said, what are you talking about? Look what you've done. Look at all the things you've accomplished. And that was the kind of guy he was. He would always turn it around and make it about you. And he ended up committing suicide. All of us were shocked because I don't think any of us that Monday night after he had taken his life, Letterman said, I knew the man for 32 years, but apparently I didn't know him well enough. And that's how I think we all felt. It was very sad that a talent like that, you know, did what he did. But depression's a son of a bitch, and it hurts a lot of people.
Yeah. Has that, has that ever really, like, struck a chord, you know, with you, you know, being, you know, obviously in the industry of, you know, doing many tryouts and, you know, all the rejections, before you hosted Double Dare. What's that like, you know, sort of going through all those auditions and audition after audition and, you know, not getting stuff or getting the role that you might not want?
Anybody who is in this industry, and especially in the world of stand-up, who would say to you they've never been depressed, they're absolutely full of crap. I was depressed. I talked to my wife when we first got married. I was eating, a box of Twinkies a day. I went from 137 to about 160 our first year of marriage because I was so depressed. I couldn't get anything going. I was trying. I was getting rejected left and right. So I would sit home and stuff my face with, pastries that weren't good for me. And then I was doing a Donnie and Marie one day, and they took a close-up of me, and I had 17 chins, and I thought, oh, my God, what has happened to me? And I went on a diet instantaneously because, you know, the camera adds 10 pounds over and above what you weigh anyway. Yeah. And it just looked like hell. So, yeah, there was a long period of time from the time I started the store in 76 until, you know, the next 10 years that I was all over the place, up and down and over and out. And, is this ever going to happen? And why did they get the break and I didn't? I mean, that's a big thing. We're all at the Comedy Store. Somebody gets picked. They go to the Tonight Show. The next thing you know, they have a sitcom. And you go, well, wait a minute. I thought I could do that. Well, what did they have that I didn't have? And it's hard not to do that, but it's also very, you know, it'll defeat you if you sit there and say, why them and not me?
Right.
You really can't do that. You got to move forward and be positive and be, have a passion for your career. But I'm telling you, show business is not for sissies. If you're a wuss, it ain't for you.
What I find so inspiring is that you and your wife have been married for so long and that you've gone through all these hardships. I mean, you've been married for 46 years. Is that right?
Yep. That's right. 46 years. But I've only been home for 14 of them, so that's why it works.
Oh, all right. Most of them on the road.
Yeah, sure. How? I feel like there's a little bit of a misconception with people today that they think they can't do both. They can't go into show business and have a healthy relationship. And I mean, you're proof that I'm sure it takes a lot of work, but that it is possible. How did?
But most comics, Don Rickles, Jack Benny, I mean, all the major comics that you think of, look at Leno and Mavis. These people have been married, you know, as long as me or longer, because I think comics, kind of put things in perspective and know what their priorities are. And, you know, I was bi-coastal for many years. I was doing a show called Couch Potatoes every Saturday and Sunday in L.A., and then I'd fly Sunday night on a red eye to Philly and shoot Double Dares from six shows a day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then Friday fly back to L.A. But I was always at my son's Little League games. You know, if I wasn't shooting, I'd take a red eye or take a 6 a.m. flight and be in L.A. by 9 o'clock and be on the baseball field to 11 because that's what you do as a father. That's an important thing. And so I think it's priorities. It's how you're brought up. I was brought up in the Midwest, a very conservative family. My parents were married for 187 years. And so
Noah?
And so, a lot of it has to do with that. And then they used to refer to me, the Comedy Store, as the accountant comedian because I was the only one who was married. I got married at 22. All these guys were out, trying to get laid and doing, blow and doing, smoking dope and all this stuff. And I did my 10-minute act and got in the car and went home. And so they thought that was odd, but it's kind of what I wanted and needed to do.
Well, it kept you focused also. I mean, I feel like the hardest thing in the world is probably to find someone that you truly love and you're going to spend the rest of your life with. So you got that out of the way early. And now it was like, all right, now the pressure's on. I have a wife. Let me, I got to start working. I got to make this happen.
Well,
get this career going.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, I had to get the career going, you know, and certain needs that you have and wants. And, you know, after being married 4 or 5 years, my wife said, you know, I'd like to start a family and like to, you know, buy a house. And so these are all things that are on the agenda. And,
right.
you know, Billy Crystal was the same way. Billy got married to Janice. They've been married, I think, over 50 years now. And same thing, you know, he had a Volkswagen and he would travel from gig to gig with Janice in the front seat, sometimes his daughter in the back seat. And so that's what you did. You know, you stayed focused. You worked your ass off. You did clubs. You did, you know, like the worst job I ever had is, but I had to pay the rent. I had a place in Sherman Oaks, California. It was $125 a month for a one bedroom. And there were times I wasn't working. And so every Sunday night, I would go to Long Beach, California and host a wet t-shirt contest for $50. And so $50 times four was $200 and I could pay the rent, you know?
Wait, you would soak yourself and then win the $50?
No, they just literally they would take a hose and hose off these girls. And, you know, and then I would come out. And I remember the first night I started, the club owner came out to me and said, "Hey, Berkowitz, keep it clean." It's like, oh, yeah, right. Okay, we're doing a wet t-shirt contest. You want to keep it clean. But, you know, these are the jobs that nobody tells you about.
Yeah.
But it, you do what you have to do to stay alive.
So you went from getting girls clean to covering people in slime.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in green liquid. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there was always some substance I was pouring on some human to do something.
Oh my God, that's great.
What about like growing up? Because I know you just mentioned your parents real quick. Were they, did they get to see, and forgive me, I don't know if they're still here. Did they get to see, you know, your success?
Oh yeah. In fact, I was in Hollywood Squares once and they were in the audience. And the producer brought them on. They got to sit in the square with me for a while.
Oh, so that was cool.
And, you know, they saw me on Oprah. I did Oprah a couple times, you know, The Tonight Show. So, yeah, my dad's been gone about 8 or 9 years. My mom is 94 and still alive and kicking.
Wow.
So she's doing fine. But, they were able to see all of it. And it was very exciting to be able to share that with them and for them to come backstage and meet some of these people and just be involved. And my brother was also very successful, still is. He's a musician and he conducted for Marvin Hamlisch for 10 years. He played drums for, you know, Liza Minnelli for years. I mean, he's been very successful. So they had two kids in show business from Indianapolis, Indiana, while he was first had a grocery store and then sold insurance. And so, you know, how that happened, I have no idea, but, you know, just worked.
And then, so they were, when you were growing up and you were trying to, you know, pursue magic and comedy, they were all for it then?
Not really. My mother thought I was going to be a professional magician. My mom said, you need to go in the insurance business with your father because you have a good personality. And I couldn't think of anything closer to hell than to, you know, call somebody up and say the word God forbid 50 times. So, you know, it was never for me. I never could do a real job. And I never wanted to do a 9-to-5 kind of thing. It just wasn't in my makeup. You know, even as a kid, I would be up all night. You know, I would go to, there was one place in Indianapolis that sold weekly variety and I would take the bus down every Saturday and pick up variety for 50 cents and read it cover to cover 3 times and go back next Saturday and do it because it was the closest to show business I could get. And, you know, I was a DJ in Elwood, Indiana when I was 15, WBMP. I was working weekends from 6 to 11. And when I left, Dave Letterman took my place. So,
really?
You know, wow. Yeah. So it's just, you know, it's weird how all these things work out and you get to know these people. And, you know, I was working on the Mac Davis Show in 76 when Dave first came out. And, you know, it's just so weird how our paths have crossed throughout the years. And you know, show business is just a weird thing. And everybody thinks we all know each other and we're all best friends, but it's just kind of not the way it is, you know. I really don't have any friends in show business. It's just not an area that I really care to get involved with. So I never hung out with a lot of people in the industry at all.
Is that what kind of works for you, that you're able to turn it off? That you're able to, you know, go do a gig and then you go home and you're 100% with your family in that moment.
Exactly. It's always worked well for me.
But I do have to ask though, has being Mark Summers helped you out in like any outrageous ways though? Like, have you been like, you know, trying to get into a restaurant or something like that where, you know, because you're Mark Summers, they're like, we'll get in here.
It always helps. And certainly working at the Food Network for 20 years has also been great. And, you know, when you can drop Bobby Flay or, you know, Guy Fieri's name or get them to say, hey, you know, I need to go to this restaurant on Valentine's Day and I forgot, can you help me out? And they'll make a phone call and magically make it happen. So, yeah, the idea of celebrity of, you know, cutting through to lines and stuff like that. Yeah, I've been very lucky. to get into hotels that were all booked or upgraded or whatever. And whatever that celebrity thing is, I will say that's one perk that I absolutely love. It's been pretty magical along the way.
I think that's why everyone tries to get into show business, is so they can get reservations and skip lines.
Just the free food and skipping lines.
You know, and I've been in lines. I was in Orlando, and they had just opened up this big ESPN place, and I was way back in the line, and the manager was walking up and down, and he said, "Excuse me, what are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean what I'm doing?" He said, "Why are you standing in line?" I said, "Well, I'm just a guy trying to get in." He goes, "Come with me." And he took me right in, you know. So when it happens like that, it's just kind of cool. And you know, for you to take three pictures and give three autographs to him, his kid, and one of the servers, it takes 2 seconds of your time. And it's easy to be nice to people. And, you know, the old thing I would say, just because you're on TV doesn't make you special. And it's nice to be important, but more important to be nice, and I try to live my life that way.
Wow. Yeah. Has anyone gone overboard, you know, like obsessed fans of yours?
Oh yeah, I've got some interesting stories with that. There's some people who are a little unusual. We had this one woman when I was hosting a talk show called Biggers and Summers on Lifetime, who flew up from the Florida area and would be stalking me out in front of the studio, and somehow got my and was calling me, and that was it.
Oh,
weird.
Wow.
And it happens. People find you and stalk you, and it's interesting. You know, they get a hold of you know, and of course now with social media, with direct message or whatever, people can find you and have bizarre requests, and will tell you various things about their lives that you really just don't want to know, but they feel that you can help them in some form or fashion. And then of course everybody thinks you're rich, and they ask you for money, and that's, you know, the other misnomer, that just because you're in the entertainment industry doesn't make you an extremely wealthy human being. So I wish I had half the money that people thought I had, but unfortunately I don't, and so I cannot write checks to everybody who calls up and says, you know, I need this. And it's heartbreaking sometimes.
You know, Mark, you never did respond to my Venmo request.
Yeah. Yeah. Ryan's been asking for a while.
Or my DM about all those pictures of you that I need.
Yes. I told you I have an eBay account to run, and you're really disrupting it.
Oh,
we don't
God.
Make any
That's
money
funny.
On this podcast. We need those photos.
I love it.
I wish we were kidding. We're not.
We're not kidding.
Yeah, we're not. But no, I mean, that's amazing. I mean, it's just funny because, you know, when I hear all, you know, fan stories like that, it's funny because when you think about it, these people don't know you. They think they know you. They think they know who you are, but they sort of concoct something in their mind of who they think you are based upon what they've seen you do on television.
Yeah. It's very true, you know, and I can tell you two stories. One, I was doing a live show in Cleveland, Ohio, and I had to catch a plane, get to the airport, and these kids kept, you know, and I deal a lot with kids and from the Nick days. And so I kept getting stopped by these kids. Could you sign this? Could you sign this? Can you sign this? And the police officer from Cleveland grabbed me by the neck and threw me against a fence. And he said, "Young man, you have a problem." And I said, "Excuse me." And he goes, "You have to stop being so nice to everybody." And it's like, oh my God, you know? And it does make it difficult sometimes, because you don't want to disappoint people, because, you know, then as soon as you have to stop the line somewhere. When people are doing pictures and autographs and they're there forever, somebody needs to cut the line off so you don't look like an idiot. And then, you know, if you're that next person in line who doesn't get one, you know, out comes the, "Hey, you asshole, you know, you think you're important because you're on TV and people start screaming at you. When the reality of it is, you know, you can't stand there for the rest of your life and do it as much as you want to, because you have a life to lead. So it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, look what we're talking about. You know, it's all so silly. I mean, the fact that anybody even wants my autograph is ridiculous. And so other people have to sort of wrangle that whole situation. And, you know, back when we were doing we started doing malls, and we were filling malls with 10,000 people, which is why we went to arenas with the Double Dare live show. And, you know, 10,000 people walk into a mall, what the hell are you supposed to do? I mean, you just can't cover everybody, and it's hard.
Yeah.
And then once again, because you're dealing with kids, you don't want to disappoint a kid in any way, shape, or form. So,
right. Does your family see that? Do they see that other side of you? Like the side that some of the fans seek? Or are they like, "Why is, you know, dad, or why is he signing, you know, all these things?" And not why, but like, do they understand that sort of that aspect.
Well, I was doing win, lose, or draw once, and we were shooting in Disneyland. And my son must have been about 8, and my daughter was 5. And we got done shooting, and they let us go, run around the park. And as I left my dressing room, I got mobbed by all these people. And my son wanted to go on Space Mountain, and my daughter was like, you know, holding one hand. And Matthew said, "Come on, Dad, come on, Dad." And Meredith said, "Done signing his autographs and doing his pictures, Matthew. We'll go to Space Mountain. So you're just going to have to be patient." And I always thought that was so funny that this little 5-year-old kid got it. And my son was like, "Who are these people? And tell them to get the hell away from me. I need to go and, be on the rides and stuff." So, yeah, I mean, all the time that happens, no matter where you go, people want to stop you in airports and, hotels or, we're out to dinner, you name it. I mean, the weirdest thing is sometimes people are rude and you'll be having dinner and they'll come. And I literally had this person one day sit down at my table and say, "People are not going to believe who I had dinner with tonight." And they sat there and I was like, no matter what I did, they wouldn't leave, you know?
It's almost like you need a police officer always there to just throw you against a wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you understand why people have bodyguards at some point, you know?
And
I'm always reluctant to go up to celebrities unless I really know them because they get bothered all the time. The one thing that happened to me where I always felt horrible and to this day, I was in New York. It was around Christmas time with my family, and they were young once again. My son was probably, 9. My daughter was 6. And we were having hot chocolate. I had just bought this new leather sort of shoulder bag backpack thing. And my daughter moved her arm, and all this hot chocolate went over this brand new bag, and it was destroying it. And a bus had just let out from a school group down at the South Street Seaport, and they discovered me. "Oh, Mark Summers, I want to get a picture with her." And I said, "Can't you see that there's cocoa all over?" And I got really huffy. And then I thought, oh, my God. And the kids turned white. And I ended up sitting there for an hour and a half and took pictures with every kid individually because I didn't want them to think this guy they watched on Nickelodeon was a total jerk. So the bag was destroyed, but I had to help those kids, and that's what I ended up doing.
Wow. I mean, it really is like being a mall Santa Claus. You have to – you're always in costume in a way.
Yeah.
Except without the beard.
Yeah, and if you're just, if you're just a stand-up comic, and not just a stand-up comic, but I mean, if that's what you do for a living, or you host a talk show, you're on a sitcom, I think you can be a little bit more, "Hey, I'm here with my family, and now's not a good time, and I appreciate you watching the show, but, this is my time," or whatever. You could do that. I was never able to do that, so I just, it's fine, it's paid the bills for many years, and I have zero complaints.
Yeah, and now, and again, like Ryan was saying earlier, you've fell into this category, obviously, of like iconic celebrities, and obviously that must feel really good. There's no way it couldn't. Is there anything so far that you have wanted to do that you haven't done?
Broadway. I always wanted to be on Broadway, and I'm still working to it at age 68 and a half. I'm still trying to make that happen. So, not to get into this too heavy right now, but, I had cancer diagnosed 10 years ago, and then I was in a car accident where I broke every bone in my face. And I thought, well, Jesus, I may not get another shot. And I've been talking about it for so long about somehow trying to audition for some theater stuff. And I talked to Bruce Valanche, was doing Hairspray on Broadway, and I had lunch with him, and he said, "You've been talking about this for years. When are you going to finally do it?" And so I called a friend who was producing Broadway shows, and I said, "I know I don't start on Broadway, but how do I get in a show? And, I know I'm kind of old and all that stuff." And he said, "I just bought a theater where we're doing summer stock. I don't know what shows we're doing yet, but, let me find out and I'll call you." And he offered me a part playing Vince Fontaine in Grease. This was like 7-8 summers ago, maybe 9 now. Mm-hmm. And so I got into that. And then I realized, oh, my God, I love this more than anything I've ever done.
Wow.
And I met a guy by the name of Drew Gasparini, who was doing stuff on Broadway. And he introduced me to a guy by the name of Alex Brightman. And Alex has since starred on Broadway in School of Rock and Beetlejuice. And he wrote a one-man show for me.
Yeah.
And so I did that first at a place called Bloomington Playwrights Project. And then we did it at the Adirondack Theater Festival. And then a documentary was shot on it. And so that's what I'm still working on. I'm still working on, the world is crazy right now with everything going on. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that someday in the near future, before I leave this earth, I get a chance to do something on Broadway.
Well, this is coming full circle because now I think this is your chance to have a crooner musical.
Right.
I think we need maybe the life of Frank Sinatra and just do that.
That would be fun. Wouldn't it be amazing? My God.
How was that experience doing Grease? Was that, I mean.
Yeah. I loved it. You know, Vince doesn't have a big role, but, you know, he's got a one meaty scene. And my biggest fear was, am I going to forget my lines every night? So I was a nervous wreck, but got through it. One night I forgot what I was supposed to say, but it turned out to be a pretty funny moment. But, you know, it's just live audiences, man. It goes back to when I did magic and stand-up. There's nothing better than a live audience, and I, that's what I miss.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really cool that you got to be able to do a show, you know, about yourself, obviously, with people who wanted to come to see more about you, and then do, you know, On Your Mark, the, you know, that documentary you were mentioning.
Yeah.
You know, it must, again, feel surreal, because it must signify, like, all right, like, whoa, like, I've made it because there's a documentary about me, you know what I mean? Like, there's a show that people are coming to see that's about my struggles and my life and my success. You know, so at the end of the day, it's very cool. And I'm just really excited to see what you do next personally. That's, you know.
Well, that's kind of, you know, I remember back, I was in high school and Merv Griffin had an hour with Bob Hope, and they were at the end of the hour, and Merv said to Bob, you know, there's been so many people who have been influential in your life. If you had to point to one person who got you from point A to point B, who would it be? And Bob Hope pointed to himself. And I never forgot that. And I kind of feel the same way, in that there were so many people in the industry who I first met who, you know, stay in touch and give me a call and I'll help you, who never came through. And so I like to think, with all due respect to all those people out there who I interacted with, the reason I am where I am is because I was passionate, never gave up, worked my ass off, and got to where I'm going. And that's why I always felt that if I was lucky enough to make it, that I was going to be able to help other people. And that's what I get so much joy in these days, is I meet young performers, and seems that everybody has my phone number or email address, and they get in touch with me, and I've taken more people to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But it's great to hear these stories of these young kids who get out of college and what their passions are, and somehow they connect with what it is I've done, and they're just asking for advice. And I, you know, advice is what it's, you know, it's worth what you pay for it. So sometimes it's worth nothing, but it's a fun part of my life to be able to help others and help them get from point A to point B.
I mean, even when you got, you know, the job hosting Double Dare, I don't think I would have called back and said, hey, what's the deal? And made it work. I think that, like you said, you're not counting on someone else to make the call for you. You're going out there and getting uncomfortable and making the call and directing your own life. And again,
I've never had an agent get me a job ever.
Wow.
No, everything that's happened, I've gotten on my own.
Wow.
They've negotiated good stuff for me, but I've never had an agent ever get me a job. And I've been doing this for 40 years, and I've been with William Morris and everybody else in between. And not one of them has ever gotten me a job.
Wow. Well, screw WME.
They're all nice. They're all good people, and they try hard. But it's a strange business.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can, like we talked about before, it's inspiring. Just the goal is to be a good person and to be kind. And
yeah, I really think so.
I wanted to personally thank you, Mark, again for doing our podcast and, you know, doing our silly show, Two Buffoons, a while back. And, you know, I really appreciate it so much. You know, again, your inspiration.
You've been very kind
to us.
I appreciate you saying that, because you've been very kind to me and given me opportunities. And once again, you know, if I can help in any way, that's why I'm here. So I wish you good luck on this thing. And hopefully it blows up and you guys become, you know, big celebrities and make all sorts of dough. And then people will be putting you on podcasts and talking to you about it.
Mark, don't be surprised if we're in a parking lot doing white t-shirts.
Yeah.
Did I say white t-shirts? Wet t-shirts.
Yeah. Wet t-shirts.
Either way. Yeah. I go, whoa, we got it wrong. We're just selling white t-shirts.
Yeah. We didn't listen to a thing Mark said.
All right, that was episode 3 of Joke Artists. Thanks for listening. Be sure to give us a follow. Subscribe at Believe.com. That's BLEAV.com. You can also subscribe on Spotify, on iTunes, on Stitcher, wherever you find your podcast. Go follow us, rate us a 5, because as we keep saying, if you don't rate us, you unfortunately
have to date us.
Yeah. And we just can't. We're running out of time. We don't have enough free time to go on dates with all of you. So if you just rate us.
Especially during the pandemic, it's very tough for us. But I mean, if you want to do it, if you have to make us do it, we'll do it.
We are doing it, but we don't want to continue doing it. So please just hit 5 stars and that'd be great. Anywho, you could do all that to keep up with us, and you can also follow Mark Summers at Twitter at Real Mark Summers is his Twitter tag. You can also
it's also his tag on Instagram too, Real Mark Summers.
Whoa! So just at Real Mark Summers across the board, you could contact Mark and say, "Hey,
I heard you on
Joke Artists,
and boy, was I horny."
Or, yeah, that's just an example. You don't have to say that. And you can also go to MarkSummersTV.com to find out everything that Mark is up to production-wise.
Yeah, and he's up to a lot. Some would say too much.
He's up to a lot of prestigious magic.
He's up to no good.
Magic. Imagine his thing that says, on this date, I'll be up to no good in Santa Monica at 7.
That'd be awesome.
People just watch from afar, like, well, he wasn't kidding.